Christopher Layden. This is The Connection. A new day is coming in Africa, but when? And from what new constellation of African and international interests? The United Nations had been building up a peacekeeping force in Sierra Leone and West Africa to contain a 9-year political rebellion that has also been a crass and savage diamond war. But suddenly the UN mission appears dazed and overwhelmed, the New York Times says today, with rebels killing civilians and still holding some 500 UN soldiers hostage. The mission to Sierra Leone was built informally as a practice round for Kofi Annan's dispatch of 5,500 UN troops to Congo in Central Africa, which is being torn apart by neighbors' raids as well as by internal warfare. But after Sierra Leone, as the UN Secretary General said last week, there's very little encouragement for outsiders to get involved in Africa. President Clinton's man at the UN, Richard Holbrooke, has been on the scene in Africa, pledging to get the intervention rules right, finally. But after the bloody American stumble in Somalia in the early 90s and the non-response to genocide in Rwanda, who can reduce the world's responsibility to right rules? Connection listeners, from Sierra Leone in the west to Eritrea in the east, there are bloody nightmare wars all over Africa, most of them far from our front pages. Our guest, Scott Peterson, has covered too many of them for the British and American papers. His book about his years in Africa, The Dark Side, is called Me Against My Brother, most particularly about wars he's covered in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. Scott Peterson, welcome. It's a fascinating book, a fascinating lot of bloodshed you've covered. I wish you'd just begin, not necessarily where you've been, but where Richard Holbrooke is today, a man who still wants to be Secretary of State, awfully smart, not necessarily wise, didn't get it all right in the Balkans, which you also know, but at least he's saying what a bloody mess we're involved in, and we haven't got it right to this point. How would you guide him out of your own experience, a man who says he wants to do it differently?
Well, I think that what we've got is Richard Holbrooke has already taken steps forward and made progress from those years of Somalia and Rwanda, where really both of those incidents kind of hamstrung the United States and also the United Nations. Richard Holbrooke is basically putting Africa back on the map and at least recognizing the significance and the importance of the conflicts that are going there, recognizing that these are not faraway places that have no impact on us, and also things that basically need to be dealt with at a high level. And so I think that if I were to advise Richard Holbrooke this time, I would ask him to take some of the things from his toolkit that he used in Bosnia. One of them was being his very, very high, hard-nosed stubbornness. You'll remember that he locked away the Balkan warlords, if you will, for weeks and weeks in Dayton, Ohio, in order to forge the accord there. The other thing that he did was he brought a high-level international interest to Bosnia, and the fact that he's doing that now to Africa is the kind of thing that, by and large, African leaders and rebel leaders and others who are able to make decisions and change things should also respond to. The fact that at the moment, Holbrooke is leading a 7-member UN Security Council team through Africa is showing such a high level interest that really we're looking at a new dynamic, one that he has ushered in.
Maybe he is a theatrical character. He has a terrific way with getting the press's attention. On the other hand, I mean, let's be real. He thought he was one step ahead in the Congo or sort of one mission down the road. And yet, the press of this war in South Africa is simply, in Sierra Leone rather, is simply awful. I mean, people question whether the Africans want a respite from the Diamond War. Also, whether in the Congo, Laurent Kabila has any intention to end the warfare there. But furthermore, he has this background of disaster, one interventionist disaster in Somalia and one non-intervention disaster in Rwanda. What's the hope of a new day here?
Well, as Holbrooke himself mentioned in his own book about the Balkans, in fact, I mean, he referred to the United States being hamstrung as the Viet Malia syndrome. The fact that he has given it the kind of high profile now is really, I think, something that is indicating that he's serious about making something happen. The problem is that for so many years, the lesson that was learned from Somalia, the one that was taken certainly by American officials, was that basically we could not intervene appropriately in Africa, and therefore we shouldn't even attempt it. The result in Rwanda was the fact that we let the genocide burn unremarked for months, which is absolutely despicable. And now it seems finally there's kind of a recognition of that. We've been going through now for the last year or so a series of apologies that people have been making, recognizing that the non-intervention then really, really was a problem, and it seems like they're trying to right it. The problem at the moment with Sierra Leone is that operation has gotten off to such a bad start that it really is overshadowing the much larger and more complex Congo conflict, to the point where it really could cause an unraveling. I think Kofi Annan is right when he says that this is something that could prove very dangerous to the Congo operation. But the problems in Sierra Leone are the fact that Fody Sanko is not interested at the moment in making peace. And so unless you've got the kinds of soldiers, the kind of commitment there that basically forces his troops to pay attention, you're not likely to corral him into accepting a peace deal.
Well, then, so what kind of intervention could work? And let's be realistic about just what it is that's not working. Op-ed pages in both the Journal and the Times this morning make the point that the kinds of troops and the numbers in which they're being dispatched by the UN are, in a certain way, an insult to the problem. These are not, this is not the 82nd Airborne. These are what Michael Maron in the Times calls a ragtag collection of third world armies thrown at a problem. They're Bangladeshis, Indians, Nigerians, Jordanians, Pakistanis. In the Nigerian case and in the African case in general, they seem to be troops that wouldn't be worthy to serve in a presidential palace guard, and they offer them up as kind of tokens, a sort of an empty gesture. They're way outnumbered by the rebels in Sierra Leone, and it sounds in this case as if, despite the blue helicopters, they very quickly get captured, disarmed, made prisoners.
I think that Michael Maron is absolutely right on this point, in the sense that you've got soldiers there who are not respected by the combatants on the ground, and unless you have that kind of respect, you are almost certainly going to be running into trouble once you get on the ground. The fact that these troops, especially the Zambians, were sent into the bush with the purpose of disarming those Sierra Leonean rebels with no maps, or at least insufficient maps, with not the kind of firepower that would enable them to get out of or escape or even kind of put off an ambush, those are the exact kind of problems that could have been dealt with if, for example, the UN troops were allowed to have built up first to maybe their full strength, their full capacity in Freetown before they ventured into the bush. And so there are things like that that simply because these troops were deployed so early, that is one of the pitfalls that I'm afraid we're probably going to see a much bigger problem with.
Imagine that Richard Holbrooke asked you, what kind of force, what kind of equipment, what kind of numbers, what kind of commitment in time might make a decisive, exemplary difference in Sierra Leone, one that would instruct the whole world, and specifically the continent, in the containment of these long, brutal wars?
I think you'd have to have more than the 11,000 that have been earmarked.
How many?
Well, I'm not sure that you need 100,000, which is the figure that Michael Maron gave, because what I think you really need is you need determination on the part of those troops. I think what you need are a well-armed and also a well-mandated unit, because often what we saw, especially in Somalia, there were questions, and in Rwanda as well, there were questions about what kind of mandate was the best one for the troops who are on the ground. Can they defend themselves, and if they can, and are they well armed enough to defend themselves? I mean, obviously these Zambians who were ambushed and taken hostage embarrassingly in Sierra Leone were not well enough armed to prevent a simple ambush like that. And so now we've got these rebels running around in Zambian military vehicles, UN armored personnel carriers. Now that could have been avoided if they had had the kind of firepower. Now it doesn't mean that you have to go in the way that American forces went into Somalia in 1992 with this doctrine of overwhelming force. You know, we're going to roll into the beaches, and And as Colin Powell said at the time, I wanted to, when we saw this incredible scene of Americans arriving on the beach that night, I was on the beach, and it was quite a remarkable piece of theater. Mm-hmm. And what Colin Powell said afterwards to say why he basically invited so many press to be there was, he said, I wanted all those Somalis to see these big, ugly Americans come on and basically be intimidated by the fact that they were there and that they were the real thing. And many times in Somalia, there were Somalis who would tell me, once the American intervention got underway, thank goodness, they said, we have really shown now for the, you know, our crisis is so serious that we deserve the Americans. We get the American level of interest. We get the, you know, it's so serious that the Americans themselves must intervene. And they were very pleased about that. And in the initial stages, were very respectful of American forces simply because of the force that was shown. Not that the Americans used it early on, but the fact that it was there was sufficient to convince the Somalis.
Well, I want you to explain with as much of your own eyewitness observation as you can what went wrong. Somalia is the root, it would seem, of the great evil story in Africa in the 90s, much as the Nelson Mandela freedom in about the same time in the early 90s and the transformation of South Africa and the start of a major reconciliation has been sort of the great rosy glow story of the 90s. What went wrong and when, just how, in Somalia? And what is to be learned in almost a decade's hindsight?
I think that the initial intervention was good, and I think it was also well-intentioned. And there are some people who debate that. They say that President Bush did this to cause troubles for Clinton when he came in. I don't think that that's true. I think that he really felt that the United States was the only nation capable of intervening in a way that would help to stop the famine. But where things began to go wrong was there were two decisions that were made very early on, which had later on devastating effect. These were made by the American commanders on the ground, and they were done on the eve of the American landing. One of them was to allow the warlords to keep their weapons in weapons cantonments throughout Mogadishu. They were meant to have been watched and monitored and everything else, but the fact was that Somalis were expecting, and a lot of others, including the UN, were expecting that the Americans were going to disarm Somalia. Certainly you would never disarm Somalia like you could never disarm Washington, D.C., for example. But the fact is that they were expecting that those larger weapons would be destroyed. The commanders on the ground decided that that was not what they were going to do. The second problem was that in the process of trying to organize a safe landing for the Marines, they made a political deal with the warlords on the ground, specifically with Mohamed Farah Aidid and Ali Mahdi, that kept them in the political process in a way that Somalis were very much expecting them to be marginalized from this process. I mean, they are war criminals as far as Somalis are concerned, and they thought, thank goodness, these people are going to be swept away and they would be taken out of the political process. But the fact was that the day after the Americans arrived, we were all standing in a tennis court over watching as these two formerly opposed warlords were shaking hands saying, we've made peace. The fact that the Americans kept them in the political process meant that they could never be taken out afterwards. And so it meant they were political players, even though they really had so much blood on their hands. But where things to finish off with the question, where things began to go wrong was the initial massacre of 24 Pakistanis in early June of 1993. What happened then was 24 Pakistanis were killed. There was the reason why they were killed was they were going to make an inspection at a radio station, even though the political members of the UN mission at the time argued that the situation was too tense to attempt this. It was too politicized an operation to carry out. The UN or the U.S. and the UN commanders on the ground made the decision to go ahead with this, mm-hmm. in part because they were angry with General Aidid and others. So they went for it. The Somalis thought that their radio station was being taken over, which it may well have been the case, and they basically attacked the Pakistanis. And simultaneously, in several places in Mogadishu, attacks started on Pakistanis. 24 people were killed. Quite a few Somalis, of course, were also killed. And the next day, before any investigation was carried out or anything else, Madeleine Albright, who then was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., literally pushed through the Security Council her guidance and also the Pakistani ambassador, pushed through a UN Security Council resolution saying those responsible are going to get nailed. In the original draft, they named General Aidid, and this was before anyone knew anything about what really had occurred. So that was the beginning of the manhunt, and it was the manhunt that ultimately caused the complete unraveling of the operation, because then we had the Americans siding against General Idiot and prosecuting this manhunt, which has never really worked. And this has been an American tactic for years and years. I mean, from Manuel Noriega, to Gaddafi, this demonization of a single individual has almost never worked in our favor, and it certainly didn't in Somalia.
Scott Peterson is our guest, a correspondent now for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been in Africa through most of the 90s. His new book is called Me Against My Brother, which comes from Somali folklore. It's the last line of a recitation you ought to give completely. But he's talking specifically about war in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda, and about the crisis of thinking, really, now about UN and American and British and otherwise intervention in the wars in Africa. Africa at war with itself in an awful lot of places. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Africa connection this hour with the correspondent Scott Peterson. 1-800-423-TALK. Charles is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Hello, Charles.
Good topic. I guess the question I have is, isn't this just more of the lack of a foreign policy from the Clinton administration? We've had 7 years plus, almost 8 years now.
Somalia, just to remind us all, was Bush time.
Well,
fighting God's war, he said.
He just made the point that George Bush went in there, to try to do a specific mission. The mission got modified. They didn't beef it up. But let's talk about, does the United States have, after almost 8 years, any policy towards Africa? Is there any foreign policy that the United States can stand tall on in that continent, one of the most important continents in the world? We talk about AIDS. We talk about this. We talk about it. It's all reactive. There's no overarching strategy that I can see.
Is there?
And then also
there?
We have this confusion between what an army does and what a police force does.
Two very good points, and I think that the word that you used toward the end, reactive, was exactly the one that I was going to use in describing the foreign policy, and we have seen this again and again and again. We saw it in Somalia because, you were right, the initial operation began with President Bush, and then when things went sour was the time when President Clinton was in power. This is really his first serious foreign policy crisis, in fact. And the fact is that you're absolutely right. I mean, we have yet to make a determination about where to deploy soldiers in ways, or even to create a force that is capable of doing this kind of work, which really is police work in so many ways. And we saw this again and again in Africa. I can't tell you how many American soldiers told me, why do they send us in here when we are trained to kill? Instead of, they send us in on this humanitarian mission like we're armed relief workers. And this is absolutely not something that they were interested in doing nor trained for. And that's the result that we got was that we really had incredible cases of killings, basically. I mean, just to give you one small example about what can be achieved if you are prepared in the proper way. During the entire Somalia operation, all the troops were armed with live ammunition, and snipers and others took out a lot of Somalis. I mean, literally 2,000 or 3,000 Somalis were killed over the course of those several months. But when U.S. troops came back to Somalia just for a few days at the end of 1995 to basically withdraw, or the end of 1994 to basically withdraw the last of the U.N. troops, there were a lot of stories about the kinds of weapons that they were bringing with them. They brought goop guns, riot control gear, BB pellets and that sort of thing, mace, other things like that that were crowd control that wouldn't harm anyone fatally, but that would be able to control the crowds. Now, why wasn't any of that stuff used, and which would have been used to great effect in Somalia earlier? I mean, there was just this kind of, the military was ordered to go in, the military did the job. The military does jobs in one single way, and they don't do them in the way that police or riot control people are trained to do, and that is a very big difference.
Charles, I would have said that Bill Clinton has made a big difference in Africa, certainly in terms of public relations in a way, but splash, he made far the most sustained trip through Africa of any president. He did the sort of mea culpa about slavery. He has embraced the kind of the promise in a way of an African renaissance. I still think the question of sort of wisdom and intervention is eludes him and eludes everybody.
I think he's made us feel good about Africa, but on his watch, more people have died in civil wars and with AIDS and probably in the entire history of the continent.
I agree, and Rwanda is the exact case of that, because here we saw so specifically a case where something could have been done demonstrably. I mean, those of us who are on the ground very much believed, as did the UN commander on the ground, who is General Romeo Dallaire, that with just a few thousand more people, UN troops on the ground, and they didn't have to be incredibly well armed or anything. It didn't take much to intimidate these groups of machete-wielding thugs. I mean, and they were no more than that. I mean, we were not dealing with well-armed and well-trained troops, like, for example, the Serbs, who took UN troops hostage. You remember also, I believe, in 1995, in Bosnia, where really you did have a problem with the opposing force being too strong. In Rwanda, just a few thousand people, a handful of people. I mean, I describe in my book cases in which literally just one or two people would save hundreds of thousands of lives simply by their presence. And that fact very much eluded this administration when they decided to just let, when they just decided to let this genocide run its course.
I wish you'd talk about that, because I don't think the book is a lot more complicated than that. You were there. You also give a more interesting description than I'd read before of the beauties, the natural beauties of Rwanda, the Switzerland of Africa. But you also leave a reader with the feeling that there was a kind of emotional plague through the whole society. That it would not, it's still almost unimaginable and unexplainable how this fever got going, and that it was not strictly politics. It was not in anybody's interest, and yet it did seem in certain ways inexorable. A tidal wave of slaughter.
The difference between Rwanda and Somalia is like night and day, because in Somalia you really had, in a lot of cases, chaos. But in Rwanda, chaos was the last thing that you had. You have a society there that has been so well ordered, so well organized, so well programmed to follow orders and to basically be a part of a political structure that was based on communes and that sort of thing, something that had been, that was set up initially by colonial rulers and others to, and by Rwanda's own native societal structure, to basically have complete and total control. So what you actually had, the reason why Rwanda was able to accomplish a genocide faster than the Nazis in terms of efficiency, I mean, look at this, 800,000 people killed in just 100 days. I mean, never before in history or in recorded history has there been such a slaughter. The only way that you could do that was by having every single person in that society take part, become culpable, be be a part of it, and that was the, and that's what they achieved in Rwanda. It was perfectly well programmed.
1-800-423-8255, the Africa Connection, with the correspondent Scott Peterson. His book is called Me Against My Brother. Siebel is on the line. Are you there?
Hello, Chris. My name is Sabla. I'm calling from the Ethiopian ADBA Women's Alliance. I am really concerned, of course. I lived here in this country for a long time. I'm very, very grateful. But the question is now, I see the Western media so much concerned about the war in Africa and the famine, and we're grateful for that. But as the slogan say, let's not mend it, let's end it. There has to be a solution to this.
And what is yours, Sybil?
Our solution is, like, we need a secure and peaceful environment in which people are free to mobilize to their best human and material asset to realize improvement of their life and education. In Ethiopia right now, the leaders we have, both in Eritrea and Ethiopia, are warmongers. They came through the barrel of the gun. Ethiopians were outraged. We told them there's no solution. These people is not going to end it. And the U.S. government say, these are our new leaders. Well, this is what happened. There was starvation during Haile Selassie's era and Mengistu. Now another generation. Children are not educated. And I suggest that women should be included in this issue, because the men are not doing it. It's all guns and war. We want education for our children. We have rivers, the Nile River, the Awash River. We have fertile lands to grow food and even to export. It's not the Ethiopians' destiny to starve and famine generation after generation. We have to end. If there is a really concern on the U.S. part or the American population, there has to be a real dialogue.
A dialogue including the West or among Ethiopians and Eritreans?
Including the West and Eritreans and all the groups. There has to be an open discussion.
I agree that I mean, at the moment, this particular famine, of which we've seen the warning flags in Ethiopia, in which 16 million people are deemed by the United Nations to be at risk, is actually one caused by three successive droughts in a row. But the problem is, as you point out, is that the war, in fact, has exacerbated the ability to deal with that famine or even to have enough money for the Ethiopians to deal with it. I mean, you're absolutely right in pointing out that at the moment, these two leaders of both Ethiopia and Eritrea came to power through the barrel of the gun and have been behaving as warmongers, because certainly there is very, very little that they're fighting over now. And for a long time, they were very, very close allies. Mm-hmm. But certainly the thing, the issue, as you point out, is really a function of education. And it's also, you're pointing out something else, too, which is crucial to understanding the problems that have plagued Africa in the last decade and even since colonialism. And that has been a very serious failure of leadership. And we see it in a lot of different places. And sadly, Africans have been plagued, the majority of Africans have been plagued by poor leadership. And you see it from country to country in different manifestations and different facets. And, you know, this is one of the reasons in Somalia, for example, when Siad Barre collapsed, he was the glue that held things together in a very, very brutal way. But once he left, there was nothing left to keep things together.
Scott Peterson is our guest, correspondent now for the Christian Science Monitor, for the Telegraph, for a number of papers around the world. We're talking about Africa. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Africa Connection. Africa against itself in the pictures drawn by our guest Scott Peterson, correspondent for newspapers now for the Christian Science Monitor, in the thick of long and ugly warfare in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. At the moment, when Richard Holbrooke in particular keeps banging his head and saying, let's get it right this time. 1-800-423-TALK. Scott, I wish you'd just tell a little bit about how you've worked from one war zone to another, all over what you keep calling the dark side of the African story. How much should we think of Africa as a war zone? And what kinds of generalizations are defensible here?
They're not too many generalizations which are defensible. I mean, the only thing that you can say about war in Africa is that war generally is bad and that wars in Africa may be worse. Certainly in the 90s, the examples that we saw were so bloody, as one of your callers pointed out before. I mean, we haven't seen such bloodshed in Africa for years, for decades even before that, and this has been an unprecedented problem. But getting into these places, the logistical difficulties, I mean, the things that you need to deal with as a foreign correspondent to get there and to work and then to get the story out are what really take up, I mean, 95% of your time. I mean, often I've joked with colleagues, when you get into a place like this eventually, I mean, often this requires like flying in, taking a chartered flight. I'll give you one example with Kigali. The night after the president's plane was shot down, which of course was the signal what started the entire genocide on the 6th of April in 1994, the next day I was on a charter flight with about four or five other colleagues. We were flying into Kigali. They closed the airspace while we were in the air, and so we literally had to fly then into southern Uganda. We thought what we calculated was that we landed this little airstrip, which is just grass, in southern Uganda, and we calculated that what we could do was try and cut through the rebel lines, which in those days were kind of behind. There was a UN ceasefire line in northern Rwanda. We were going to, you know, say hi and charm our way basically through the rebel lines to try and get to Kigali, which is where this incredible bloodletting, which was already clear was going on, was happening. Basically, we got to the front line. They took us on a tour. The night that we were there, the Tutsis themselves, the Tutsi rebels, started their own offensive toward Kigali, said, no, sorry, you can't go. And we had to backtrack all the way up to Uganda and by pure chance, for example, caught this World Food Program flight. We just sat down to lunch, very dejected, in Entebbe, Uganda, sat down, and by chance we're sitting next to a World Food Program person. The guy said, oh, I've got a flight that's going into Kigali on an empty, huge, old Russian flight. Plane. It was huge, mammoth, normally used for shipping food. We got on that plane, we landed, the plane had flown totally illegally. This guy had just wanted to see the situation, and literally, he stepped off the plane. The UN troops were on the ground, said, what are you doing? Get this plane out of here. We just jumped out and ran across the tarmac, and we're gone, basically, and then we were in. And once you're in, then you're able to, I mean, then you just have to start. Hopefully, if you've got a wad of $100 bills in your pocket, start working out transportation, working out how to get things. I mean, during that genocide, the way that we had to work in Kigali was, first of all, there were so many people exiting that there were all these cars, diplomatic cars and others, just sitting on the tarmac at the airport. Many still had keys. Many had petrol in them. I stole a beautiful Swiss embassy four-wheel drive. It had a great stereo system. It had a quarter of a tank of gas. I mean, it was wonderful. So that's what I was driving around with for the first few days. And people just had different kind of vehicles. Later on, when not so many of those vehicles were available, I remember some nights we'd go out about a month into the genocide, we had to stay at the UN compound. It was about the only safe place in at that particular time in which to stay. And we'd go out in the middle of the night, flak jackets on, and crawl around to the few vehicles that were just on the outer perimeter that had been left, and literally siphon gas out of those cars into tanks so that we could then pour that into our own car so that we had enough gas to get around. Now, of course, you're not always driving your own car. Sometimes it's far too dangerous. We're driving with UN people. We're driving any way you can go, but it's very free form. It's something that is to get through it and to know what your requirements are in terms of food. I mean, sometimes you go without food for a couple of days. You're sleeping, you don't know where. I mean, it really is a wide open thing when you go in. And this, I mean, once you've done it several or many times and gotten through it, then you're able to deal with it mentally. But in your first instances, I mean, I'm very grateful, for example, that this genocide was not my first story. If that were my first story that I was covering, I mean, the shock that I think probably first readers of this book will experience in some cases with these kind of descriptions and things, it's just so beyond our normal experience that...
You were there in the spring of 94 when this was going on. What did you think you were in the middle of? What kind of an event did this seem to you? And again, on the generalization question, I mean, what bearing as a sort of human crisis did this have on, say, what you'd experienced in Somalia, what's going on in Sierra Leone or in the Congo today? Is this the same virus?
No, this is a very different virus, and we knew that in Rwanda the entire time. In fact, I hope if anything like Rwanda ever happens again, I don't cover it, because it was just too... There was just too much human and emotional baggage and impact in that. I mean, it's one of the reasons I had to write this book. I mean, I felt I had to cleanse myself of all these things, never mind feeling duty-bound by having witnessed so many of these things, and therefore feeling that I had to produce a historical record because there's so few of us who really were witnessing those things. But I felt that I just had to really cleanse my mind and soul of some of these things. And so the result has been this. But Rwanda was a very special case in the sense that, I mean, for me, for example, the most intense moments of fear I have ever felt have been associated with the Rwanda story, because we were inside a lot of the time. And in fact, one of my worst moments of fear, which I describe in the book, occurs that first night before we even get into Rwanda, when we were at this little town where the plane landed in southern Uganda. I turned on the BBC. There was a former BBC correspondent who happened to be in Kigali at the time and was sending back reports, live reports, saying the bodies are piling up at the checkpoints. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, these kind of like breathless reports that were so shocking that I really looked into myself and felt fear. I thought, how could I possibly myself want to go in there? How will I be able to be safe in such a circumstance? And I was so frightened of that, I really just spent the night clutching my pillow and praying, and questioning why this was something I wanted to do. Now, once I got inside, a lot of that fear abates, and this happens in many circumstances, not just in Rwanda, but it would happen if you were going into Sierra Leone now, when we went into Somalia. Once you're actually inside, you have a much better grasp on what your options are and how you can secure yourself and how you can be safe. And so you can then manage it at a justifiable level, whereas when you're outside, often the demons just come to get you, and you really have to be experienced, I think, often to kind of keep that under control.
Scott Peterson is our guest. His book is called be against my brother about his own coverage of war in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. Ansu is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Ansu.
Yes, it's an honor hearing from a guest who has written a book on Africa. But I think the underlying issue we're faced with in Africa, I would like to first retract the statement he made that we have not had good leadership in Africa. Of course, we have had good leadership. But the problem is we have not gotten the kinds of support from the West that we should have whenever we have good leadership. In the case of Ghana, Nkrumah, in the case of Liberia, Thurgood. These two leaders call for the transfer of basic technologies from the West, especially in the area of agriculture and education. But the West have never lived up to its obligation to transfer basic technology. They've only taken away the natural resources. And now we see the human resources too. So all these allegations of not having good leadership, Africa not doing its part, is wrong. The West has to live up to its obligation. There has to be the transfer of certain basic technology, especially in the era of education and healthcare. If we don't, we cannot achieve the purpose of employment, which is very much essential for economic development. So I think the West has to now produce those two areas of initiative that is very important for economic development in Africa.
On stand by. Scott Peterson.
I would contest the generalization that it's just not true that there have been failures of African leaders, in part because we've seen so many of them. I do take your point about the two that you mentioned, but take a look, for example, at some of the leaders who are there at the moment. I mean, President Moi in Kenya, for example. I mean, Siad Barre in Somalia. You look at Bashir and Turabi in Sudan, and you look at all the cases. I mean, those who are also even now leading Liberia and many other ones, Zaire. What you find is you often find eventually, and I mean, look at Mugabe at the moment. I mean, people who are willing in the final analysis to resort to either kind of feeding the fans of feeding the flames of tribalism or something else in a way that they are doing it for their own personal ability to cling to power, to keep that grasp of power, even at the risk of their entire countries falling apart. I mean, they're willing to do that. I mean, at the moment we're seeing, for example, this case in Zimbabwe with Mugabe pushing veterans and basically encouraging them to do something that is very, very popular in Zimbabwe, which is kind of occupying these white farms and that sort of thing, but at the risk of very serious violence, the kind of things that really are going to lead to a much longer term instability. And we've seen that kind of thing elsewhere. We see it in Kenya. We see it in Kenya, which is always kind of held up as a relatively stable example. You see pushing for tribalism and that kind of leadership, and that's what I mean by failure.
Ansu, I wonder if you want to apply your point specifically to Zimbabwe, where there is clearly a problem of redistribution and sort of trickle down of technology and just plain ownership. What's your view on the Zimbabwe situation?
Well, Zimbabwe and South Africa, remember those two societies were governed by whites before independence. So as a result, the basic institutions were well structured and created. So the independent black African majority took over a society that was structured. But take the case of Liberia, for example, which was settled by free slaves. When the slaves went in, there was a majority of Liberians there, of Africans, who say, what did they find? They find rubber, iron ore, and other commodities. And the United States, who helped to create the society, did not exploit the effort of industrializing those areas. And so for almost all of the independent years of Liberia, we have been calling that we need these kinds of development. We can't have our rubber and our iron ore just being put on the ship and taken away. How are we going to create jobs?
I agree that there's no problem that, or that there's no question that that these countries have been exploited by businessmen and by others from the outside. There's no question about that, and there's no question that Africans and African rulers have been harmed by that. In part because it has helped to increase corruption, and it has caused in a lot of respects the kind of problems that these days we see in Sierra Leone and Zaire, where people are so hungry for those kind of resources that you've got not just outsiders who are willing to help finance wars. I mean, we see this in Angola today. But what you see, I mean, is you've got people who are willing to stay at war and are not at all interested in peace because of the material gains that they're getting from all those resources. And it's not just coming from outsiders. I mean, there are six foreign nations at war in Zaire, and in large measure, they're there not because they love Laurent Kabila or they love being on the Rwanda-Uganda side for ideological reasons. They're there because Zaire is rich in diamonds and timber and all the other things that they just don't find in their own home countries. The same thing applies to Angola, where you've got Savimbi, who has earned billions in the last few years, able to finance this incredible rebel movement, which should have died a death a decade ago. When I was in Angola, we thought that was all going to happen. Savimbi's taken those guys back to the bush, and the places he clings on to more than anything else are those diamond-producing areas. So those are very, very real issues, and you're right to point out that they are the ones that have caused huge problems. I'm not sure that further development is going to solve those problems, because those are problems in the system that basically prevent the kind of outside investment in those countries that would be for development from occurring.
Ansu, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Mark is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Mr. Peterson?
Yes.
I just had a question. I was trying to formulate it while I was listening to the other people talk. Do you think a lot of the conflicts, you know, whether it's the Serbian situation or there in Somalia, is its root cause has to do with people's philosophy as far as their concept of what they believe as opposed to their neighbor, what they believe? And if that's true, is the intervention by the United Nations with, you know, whether it's with pain or pressure or, you know, military type intervention, whether or not that really resolves it, and that doesn't just reveal the inability of the United Nations to just actually change people's thinkings to where they think right, as far as allows them to live peacefully one with another?
Well, I think that I'm not sure how much action is taken on the basis of ideology. Often what you really see at work are people just looking for opportunities, making decisions, and those are the reasons why they decide, yes, peace is a good idea or not. For example, just looking at the case of Sudan at the moment, there is a good argument, I think, against the United States giving food or any other kind of support to John Garang, who is the Christian rebel leader in southern Sudan. Why? Because if he sees himself as having American backing, which is of course the great superpower, why should he possibly, or why is it in his interest necessarily to make a peace when he feels he's got the one last superpower in the world on his side? Why should he push for peace? Why shouldn't he just keep fighting, get as much as he can? And basically that is simply an opportunity that Garang would see as a function of that kind of outside support. But we see this, I mean, we see this in Africa in the sense that outside, how outsiders influence and make decisions for locals and for those like John Garang, and that influences whether or not they're interested in peace or not.
Mark, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Africa connection with Scott Peterson. Jeff is on the line.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Jeff.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you in a lot of points you said about Africa, you know, about the political system, the leadership, and there is no constitution in all those countries. You know, I'm from Africa there, you know.
Where are you from, Jeff?
From the Sudan.
Okay.
You know?
Wonderful country.
Yes. You know, as you know, the war in the Sudan started before any war in Africa, since 1956.
Yes.
More than 8 million people died in this war, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the West, for example, the Clinton administration, Britain, all these countries, you know, they don't want to interfere to stop the war. And at the same time, you said something wrong about Joe Garang. Joe Garang by now occupies about 70% of the Sudanese lands, you know?
Well, I, as far as I understand, he occupies the southern half only. It depends on whether you include elements that are controlled by the upper, on the eastern front, basically, which is up in the eastern side along the Eritrean border, but...
Every town there, except Port Sudan, every town there is occupied by Jogarang right now.
Well, in that case, there won't be much of that oil going out from Khartoum, or
there
coming from the south.
There will be no oil, you know, there will be no oil, you know?
How, go ahead.
Yes, but why the concentration is always in Rwanda, Sierra Leone, you know, Somali? Those people, you know, they get their independence in the 60s, and the war is starting in Sudan since 1956, you know?
But I think that one of the problems is the fact that it has been going on since 1956. The fact is that people have heard about war in Sudan for such a long time that it's easy for them to turn it off. It's the same thing that we see in the Balkans now. Who follows day-to-day what's going on in Mitrovica and Kosovo? I mean, they've had it, basically, with wars going on in the Balkans for a decade. What about the Middle East peace process, which I'm covering these days? We hardly write about it in a lot of respects now, because people are just not interested, and they turn it off. The reason why Sudan has become, it has gotten a bit more ink these days, is because there is that renewed U.S. interest. But I very much take your point, and you're absolutely correct in saying that the United States has not been pushing for the kind of peace in Sudan that it is capable of pushing for.
And why not? Jeff, what's your own view? What is your own view of why the world...
That's why I'm asking, really, why not, you know?
Well, the reason, as far as I understand, is that there really is a battle going on in the administration between those who are interested in totally isolating Sudan, which I think is a wrong policy, and those who are interested in basically, interacting with Sudan and speaking to them and holding a kind of dialogue. When I was last in Sudan, which was immediately after the August 1998 cruise missile strike on Khartoum, when U.S. cruise missiles destroyed that El Shifa pharmaceutical factory, I'd been on the blacklist for 5 years, but because they knew they were onto a good thing, they opened the floodgates and all these journalists came in. I met the foreign minister, who I've known for quite some time, and met some other officials who convinced me that there are some moderate elements within that government who basically are interested in cleaning up Sudan's act, getting rid of this terrorism image. I mean, after all, they did kick out bin Laden back in 1995, and that didn't come for free for them. So there were steps that they were taking, and their sense was that the United States was and the White House was not interested in paying attention or even recognizing that it might be in Sudan's own self-interest to make peace and therefore take their protestations that they wanted peace very seriously.
Jeff, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Africa Connection with Scott Peterson. John is on the line.
Hi there.
Hello, John.
I've been listening very attentively, only to find that many of the points I was about to make have already been covered. But maybe I have a couple of things to say. I've been involved with an Ethiopian woman for several years, and we often have very heated conversations about the state of Africa politically. And she's always accusing me of just not understanding the realities there. And what I see it is, you know, just the basic philosophies that fuel the governmental policies like tribalism, patriarchy, warlords consolidating power for their own personal gain, and just the corrupt, rotten
systems,
government systems that just don't work. And I see as Africans are basically just hanging on to the worst, doggedly hanging on to the worst parts of African culture.
John, I want to give Scott Peterson a chance to wrap it up. The reader of your book, Scott, could take away this impression that there is a stubborn African problem. I mean, this is in the realm of dangerous generalization.
I think it is, because I think that there really are places where there is hope, and I think there are things also where there are things that you can learn from the examples of the past, bloody as they have been. And one of the purposes of this book has very much been to highlight ways and kind of at least look very closely at where things have gone wrong in the past, so that in the future we won't make the same mistakes.
It is a grimly fascinating and beautifully written book. Scott Peterson, thank you. It's called Me Against My Brother at War in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, Nahani Rouse, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to all the news, administrators at a school in Buxton, Maine, are considering a policy to ban students' cell phones and pagers. And a report on an exhibit.